today on Against the Grain. What role did slavery in the Caribbean play in capitalism's emergence in Britain? I'm CS. Steve Cushion discusses his new book, Slavery in the British Empire and Its Legacy in the Modern World, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Very few parts of the world were untouched by the British Empire or remain unaffected by its legacy today. The empire started with and got its financial power from the business of slavery. The profits from trafficking and enslavement were significant in financing the Industrial Revolution in Britain. Atlantic slavery was inextricably interwoven with the markets, commodification, capital growth, credit, and raw materials that were required for the expansion of capitalism in Europe and North America. So writes Steve Cushion in a new book titled Slavery in the British Empire and Its Legacy in the Modern World. Steve Cushion is Senior Research Fellow at the Institute of the Americas at University College London. When Steve and I connected recently, I asked what spurred him to write this book.
I'm involved with an organization in London called Caribbean Labour Solidarity. Some friends of mine in an organization in Hackney, in East London, called Hackney Stand Up to Racism, started a campaign against a local museum that had a statue of a slaveholder. Prominently in front of it, Robert Jeffrey, and used to be called the Jeffrey Museum. My friend said, basically, "Here, Cushion, you're a historian. Can you do some work on Jeffrey?" So I did, and I wrote a pamphlet for them. Then some other friends, comrades of mine down in Dorset, who were campaigning against another descendant of a slaveholder who's still a rich man in the area and a Conservative Member of Parliament, asked me to do some work. A man called Robert Drax, they asked me to do some work on that. So I wrote a pamphlet for them. And then suddenly I thought, why don't you just put it all together, expand it all, and that became a book. But it started as a series of basically agitational pamphlets against the history of slaveholders in England.
And by slaveholders in England, do you mean English people who, for a time, held slaves in the British West Indies?
One of the things that I'm keen to push in the book is what I call, well, what Josephine Ikori called the business of slavery. So there are the slave traders, the traffickers who moved people across the Atlantic. There were the people who bought them and made money there. There were the people who... the financial services industry that made vast profits out of financing all this. And then there was the British petty bourgeoisie who clipped coupons. So there's many people who were not actually involved in slave trading, slave owning, but who profited from it, often at arm's length. And I include all of them in what I call the business of slavery.
How do we begin to talk about the impact that the slave trade and the plantation economy had on the development of industrial capitalism in Britain? Maybe we could start rather early on. So we have capitalism as it was emerging and evolving in Britain. How reliant was the capital creation and capital propagation of that system on the slave trade and the institution of slavery?
I would suggest something that used to be called the primitive accumulation of capital. An important section of that initial finance did come from the business of slavery one way or another. But it wasn't just that. It linked in with what in Britain we know as the enclosures, whereby common land was seized by local landowners and the local peasantry were driven off the land. And also with the colonization of India, that all of these things were important in the development and providing that initial capital for the development of industrial capitalism. In the early days, the money that was made from sugar was a very important source of funding for industrial development. The next thing that was important was the industrial development of the steam engine became important for then the further development of sugar production in the British Caribbean. So there was a kind of a circle, if you will, between the two. The next thing that was important, of course, was cotton production in the United States, which became very important for the development of the cotton industry in Lancashire. And that was really one of the driving forces of what we call the Industrial Revolution. So I think there is this, to use a hackneyed phrase, there is a dialectical relationship between the money that is made from slavery that then goes into industrial development and agricultural development in Britain, which then feeds back into slavery, both in what was then the British West Indies and into what became the United States of America.
Do we have any sense of what proportion of the profits made from capitalist firms in Britain can be related to, can be said to be generated by or made possible by the influx of, for example, cotton and sugar produced by enslaved labor in the Americas?
I don't deal very much with statistical economics, with macroeconomics. What I've tried to do in the book is to look at those industrialists who were important in the development of industrial capitalism in Britain, and I look at the United States as well, and see how they made their particular money. Pat Hudson and Maxine Berg have done a remarkable job of taking on what I call the bourgeois economists on their own terms, but that's not the way I approach it. I'm looking much more at what happens to individual enterprises, because I think that's where the Industrial Revolution took place.
You mentioned a Robert Drax. Tell us about the Drax family and how it profited from enslaved labor.
The Drax family have been, I mean, they're a wonderful study for what I've done. The first Drax arrived in Barbados in 1627. He was one of the first settlers there. He was one of the first importers of enslaved Africans. He was the one who built a relationship with some exiled Dutch, previous slaveholders who'd been driven out of what was to become Brazil. Then there was another generation of Draxes that pursued that. And we have the instructions that particular Drax wrote to his foreman in Barbados when he left and went back to live in England. You can really see the early development of modern human resource management in the way that he moves himself as the capitalist away from the actual management of his plantation, collects the money, issues instructions from a distance, but relies upon a manager to do this. And so that was then important. There's another generation of Drax who were then just drawing money off it, but became important landowners in the west of England, and the members of parliament, and you can see how they used their control, that they were part of that West India interest that used their alliance with the other landowners and their control of, therefore, of parliament to ensure their own interests. And it goes right on up to today, where the recent member of parliament for Dorset, who was yet another Drax, his first name escapes me for the minute, who was member of parliament, the biggest landowner in the county, and refused to accept that the money they had made out of exploiting enslaved Africans was anything to do with him. You asked at the beginning about how I got involved in this. Well, some comrades down in Dorset asked me to do this pamphlet, and that pamphlet then became part of a campaign that they used to unseat this Conservative Member of Parliament. And for the first time in years, they didn't have a Conservative Member of Parliament for the for that particular constituency. Now, I'm not saying that it was a result of this. There was a whole range of dissatisfaction with this this man. But I do think it was nice to have helped and contributed towards that by just taking a look at how this family had exploited both enslaved labour in the Caribbean, where they still own a plantation, and had also exploited workers in Britain at the same time.
Steve Cushion is my guest. He is a senior research fellow at the Institute of the Americas at University College London. We are talking about his new book, Slavery in the British Empire and Its Legacy in the Modern World. It's published by Monthly Review Press. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So you referred to the way in which the financial services industry in Britain, the role it played in the propagation of slavery and the making of profits off of slavery in Britain. Are we talking here about the lending of money, the providing of credit to slaveholders in, say, the British West Indies, or the maybe insurance that was provided, that was furnished to people who were doing risky things in relation to the slave trade, or both, or maybe there are many other things involved?
There's a whole range of things. I mean, you mentioned insurance. The origin of the idea that you can insure human life comes from the days of slavery. Before the question of insuring a slave ship, the church considered insuring human life as betting on God's will. So it wasn't really accepted. But of course, an enslaved African was both a human being and property. Much of the insurance industry, and we're talking, there are still companies in England called things like the Royal Liverpool Insurance, Lloyd's of London, of which everyone has heard, were very much involved in insuring the slave trafficking ships. And because, of course, all sea travel in those days was risky, but of course there was the added risk that the enslaved Africans could rebel. So that was one of the aspects, the basis of the modern insurance industry. Up until about 10 years ago, we used to refer to people as merchant bankers in England. It seems to have dropped out of currency at the minute. But they started as what were known as merchants in the West India trade, which is why they were called merchant bankers, because it was a very costly, potentially very profitable, but a very costly business, the trafficking of Africans to the Caribbean. A ship had to be provisioned with cotton, iron, guns, and so on, and fitted out in a special way. And there were chains and so on. So that had to be, they needed credit for that. And then when they arrived, the enslaved Africans arrived in the Caribbean, the immediate enslavers who were going to use them for production on the plantations needed to borrow money. This is also, therefore, the origin of what became the letter of credit. And so much depended upon whether the bank or the group of bankers that issued a letter of credit could be trusted to redeem it. So all of this is deeply bound up in that original development of the instruments of capitalism. Then you have, there was the South Sea Company. I mean, now I don't know if it's known much in the United States, but every school child in England has heard of the South Sea Bubble, which was a stock market crash caused by over-speculation. What most people don't know is that the South Sea Company was a slave trading company that was actually, in one sense, part of the British state. So it's all very much entwined.
And also entwined in all this, and you began to talk about this, is the question of mechanization, which was spurred in large part by the development of the steam engine, the coal-powered steam engine by James Watt. What did that machine have to do with productivity, particularly in the sugar refining process in Britain? Again, so this is sugar coming from plantations in the Caribbean in raw form, and then it's refined in Britain. How important was the steam engine in the momentum toward exploiting enslaved labor?
There's two aspects of this. One is that the development of the steam engine intensified labor in the Caribbean because it enabled the crushing of the cane and so on to be mechanized and to be more regulated. But it also enabled coal mining to take place in much deeper mines and so on, and was also implicated in the development of copper as an important resource because you needed the copper for the steam engines, but also it helped develop the copper industry, which then was extremely useful because the wooden ships of the time needed copper cladding on the bottom to stop the various parasites that live in tropical waters from destroying the boats. And this brings in, therefore, the question of the slave trade could not have existed without the Royal Navy. We hear a lot about how the Royal Navy in later days had a West Africa patrol to stop slave trades. But in the early days, it could not have existed without the Royal Navy because pirates and other and the ships of other countries would have stolen, in inverted commas, their slaves. So copper is deeply bound up in the whole question of slavery, to the extent that even in the last days of enslavement in Cuba, slave labourers were working in the copper mines near Santiago in a town called El Cobre, which of course is Spanish for copper. And these mines were owned by capital that originated in the city of London. So there's this kind of, again, this relationship between copper, steam and slavery. And of course, that steam engine was the start of global warming as we know it today, as our friend Andreas Malm has so eloquently described.
Right, the mining of coal that was necessitated by the steam engine and the demands created by the use of that steam engine, that was, what would you say, one of the beginnings of the dependence on fossil fuels by capitalist enterprises, by capitalism as an institution?
Yes. And Andreas Malm's book on this gives chapter and verse on how and why they moved in Britain, where the textile industry moved from water-powered production methods, which is how it started, through to steam-powered, because that enabled them to move production nearer to the sources of labour in the city. Whereas when they had to rely on water, they had to rely on rural labourers in villages who, through communal solidarity, could actually demand more wages. So, yeah, that's really important. You're quite right.
This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Steve Cushion is a senior research fellow at University College London's Institute of the Americas. He is the author of A Hidden History of the Cuban Revolution, How the Working Class Shaped the Guerrillas' Victory. He has a PhD in Caribbean labor history. We are talking about his new book, Slavery in the British Empire and Its Legacy in the Modern World. We have a link to that book on our website, againstthegrain.org. And just to follow up on the question of British banking corporations giving credit that, you know, facilitated, that to some degree allowed the slave trade to continue, it allowed many slaveholders who could not afford enslaved laborers to purchase them, right? They would get loans. You write that loans made to slaveholders were often secured by mortgages, basically mortgages on slaves. Tell us about that.
The mortgages were technically on the land, but the land was worthless without the labour to work it. The most valuable thing that a plantation owner had was his enslaved labour. So that therefore became collateral, if you will, for loans that they received, often to buy more enslaved labour and so on. But of course, quite often, as in any business, an enslaver would go bust, would become bankrupt. And this is an interesting thing about the development of the anti-slavery campaign in Britain, that there were bankers who, while themselves were opposed to slavery, had lent money to enslavers who then went broke, and they became slaveholders themselves by kind of that business, the way that bankruptcy works, that you, if you're owed money and the person who owes you money goes bankrupt, you get their assets. So a classic one of this is the Barclays. Now, there is still a Barclays bank in England, but the Barclays themselves were opposed to slavery, but they had lent money to enslavers who had gone bankrupt, and so therefore they ended up owning slaves. And that is one small aspect of why some of the British bourgeoisie turned against slavery, was that it was causing this contradiction between what might be their religious values and the profit. Now, of course, normally in those circumstances, profit wins, but they wanted a way out of this. So I think that's that is an important, it's a minor factor, but it is a factor in the development of the anti-slavery campaign in Britain.
Steve, how prevalent is the notion that individuals like William Wilberforce freed the slaves in the British Empire?
It was absolutely what we were brought up with. Now, I'm in my 70s now, but when I went to school in the 50s, it was what we were taught. Wilberforce freed the slaves. And as I say in the book, the British bourgeoisie have come to believe that this is part of their self-image, and they believe their own propaganda now. And what is always neglected in history is the fact that the biggest popular campaign in British history is the anti-slavery campaign. More workers signed petitions against slavery than signed the petition for the vote that the Chartists organised in the 1830s. And the first in any way democratic government that happened in Britain was after the 1832 Reform Act. And in 1833, enslavement, this process of abolishing it was started. And then the other thing that is always neglected here is the role of the enslaved in the Caribbean, who rebelled, who went on strike, who escaped into to live in either free communities in the mountains or to live as bandits or whatever. The role of the enslaved workers themselves in securing their, in making slavery eventually appear untenable. And so I would argue that what we have here is the main force for the abolition of enslavement, I would argue, was slave rebellions in the Caribbean, a mass popular campaign in Britain, that was the driving force of it, and that Wilberforce and Clarkson, I don't think they would have got anywhere without those two forces behind them.
Now, this mass movement against slavery that was doing its thing in Britain, how much did it rely on workers, working class organizations, working class political organizations that came to feel very strongly that not only that slavery was immoral, but that the fate of the working class in Britain was somehow tied to the fate of enslaved labor in the British West Indies?
I think you make a good point there, that there was a moral revulsion, but moral revulsion, to be effective, needs to be tied to practical interest to be effective. And I see that radical workers and other radicals in Britain saw that what stood in the way of their democracy were the same people that stood in the way of the abolition of enslavement. And they saw that what was known as the old corruption, that was an alliance between the landed aristocracy and the sort of arriviste money that came from the West Indies, that bought its way into the landed aristocracy and married its daughters into it. And that it was this interest that stood in the way of democracy and workers' rights. The earliest serious opposition to enslavement came not just to the slave trade, but to enslavement itself, came from the Sheffield steel workers, iron workers, who absolutely recognised that connection between the old corruption and their own oppression. Now, Wilberforce, while he spoke very much in favour of the abolition of the slave trade and later supported the abolition of enslavement generally, nevertheless opposed all these democratic demands. He voted in Parliament for all of what were known as the gagging acts, a whole series of acts of Parliament that restricted free speech, that restricted working class organisation and so on. And he could have gained much more support by saying to workers that the exploitation and oppression of enslaved workers in the Caribbean can be likened to your exploitation in Britain. But he never said a word about that, and he opposed all working class organisation. And it was the radicals in Britain, the early Chartists, the Sheffield Steelworkers, who I've mentioned already, the London Corresponding Society, Tom Paine Society for Constitutional Information, and so on, that were the first to really oppose slavery generally. And one more point on this, the anti-slavery movement in Britain, the official one, was segregated. but there were a large number of what were referred to as ladies' anti-slavery society. And by and large, they were much more radical than the official male ones. Elizabeth Hedrick, who was one of the leaders of the women's movement against slavery, is famously quoted as saying, because the official society was called the Society for the Gradual Abolition of Slavery. And she said, I hope that no ladies' society will ever have the word gradual associated with it.
His name is Steve Cushion. He's a retired university lecturer who is now senior research fellow at the Institute of the Americas at University College London. He's written about Caribbean labor history, anti-Nazi resistance, the Grenadian Revolution, and climate change. We are talking about his book, Slavery and the British Empire and Its Legacy in the Modern World. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. What did Eric Williams argue in his book, Capitalism and Slavery? Now, this book came out in the 1940s. About what spurred the British government to abolish the slave trade, which it did first, and later emancipate, I think effective 1838, and later emancipate the enslaved in the British West Indies.
His argument was that it was not a moral Christian crusade, as it were, but that there were material interests involved. He argued, one of the things he argued that has been contested was that there was a reduction in profitability of the whole question of the slave economy. Now, that's been contested by kind of macroeconomists who can produce statistics about all sorts of things, but that's another question. I would argue that while there hadn't been an absolute decline in profitability, there had been a relative decline in profitability compared to the money that could be made out of industrial capitalism. But that industrial capitalism requires a different kind of state. They need free trade, whereas the sugar industry, which was less profitable in the British West Indies than it was in Cuba, in Brazil and so on, needed protectionism. And it was, I would argue, it was a contest over control of the state that was often fought out in terms of abolitionism, as it was in terms of reform of parliament and so on. Williams' book was first 1944. It was released in the United States. It was somewhat later than that before he could find a publisher in England, because it so went against the kind of benevolent mythology of the British ruling class that weren't we good, we freed the slaves. Forgetting, of course, that to hold them, to free them. But anyway, but you can pick holes in it here or there. There's been more research that shows that the things he said weren't quite as sustainable as he was. But the basic argument that he gave, that there were economic factors involved in the abolition of slavery, I think, is still beyond question.
Well, there's so much in this book, Slavery and the British Empire and Its Legacy in the Modern World. Let's talk a bit about something else addressed in the book in another chapter. It's about the stance that the British aristocracy took toward the Civil War in the US. So what can you tell us about that?
Having abolished slavery in the British Empire, that industrial capitalist class that had basically won that dispute with the landed aristocracy and what we call the West India interest, depended very heavily on cheap cotton from the United States, particularly from the southern states of the United States, what was to become the Confederacy. And they took the attitude, and we have quotes from members of Parliament who say, well, I'm not responsible for that. I'm only responsible for what happens in the British Empire, basically. And so when the Civil War in the United States broke out, the British ruling class very much favoured the Confederacy because that was where their cheap cotton came from. And they could close their eyes to the fact that it was picked by enslaved labour. And there was a real move, particularly supported by many of the kind of bourgeois newspapers, to, first of all, to recognise the Confederacy. And then when the Navy of the Union of the North put a blockade on various, to force that blockade so they could get their cotton. I would argue that the thing that stopped them getting involved in this was the massive campaign amongst cotton workers who made it quite clear, this is in Lancashire, made it quite clear that they would not work cotton that was picked by enslaved labour. There was a massive campaign throughout the north of England and in London of support for the union. And it had an interesting knock-on effect, really, that Marx and Engels in London were very involved in this campaign, and it gave them the spur to help in the organisation of what became what we now know as the First International, the International Working Men's Association, that started very much on two issues: independence of Poland from the Russian Empire, and solidarity with the North. I mean, now Marx himself was very impatient with what he saw as Lincoln's shilly-shallying, but nevertheless, that was a massive campaign, and I think this is, if you like, the high water point of internationalism within the British working class movement. And it's something that the British labour movement is still proud of to this day.
Yeah, and those strong worker convictions were, as you write, despite the cotton famine, because the severe shortage of raw cotton from the US South meant that workers in Britain, cotton workers, were endangered. In fact, you write that half of cotton workers in Britain were unemployed by 1963, and there were other wage cuts. So they were really being hurt by the Civil War and by the cotton famine, and yet they supported the side that would end slavery in the US.
I think there was a realization that while slavery existed in the United States, that they would never be free, if you will. Marx writes a lot about this, and I think this was a turning point in his understanding of the world, that seeing this mass movement, and bear in mind that a lot of his old German comrades from 1848 had gone to the United States and then were very solidly in support of the Union. I mean, in St. Louis, for instance, the German-American communists were instrumental in keeping St. Louis in the Union, driving out the Confederate governor. So there was a transatlantic toing and froing that I think has been underestimated, the importance of that internationalism that has been, if I may say, as a political point, we could deal with a bit more of today.
That's the voice of Steve Cushion. He is talking about his new book, Slavery and the British Empire and Its Legacy in the Modern World. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Getting back to your earlier point about enslaved people playing an essential role in their own liberation, you say that there weren't a lot of large-scale revolts, major slave rebellions, because of course the risk to life and limb that enslaved people would have to take in order to engage in something like that. One major slave revolt, however, was the Demerara Rebellion in Guyana. Again, this is the British West Indies in 1823. How did that originate and unfold?
I see that as part of a pattern. That news of discussions about the abolition movement in Britain arrive in the Caribbean. And I think this is, it's not just Demerara, this is a common pattern. News arrives of discussions in Parliament. The slaveholders in their local representative assemblies then start going really over the top about how this is a disgrace, this will, you know, this will be the end of it all, and so on. And this appears in local newspapers. Enslaved people, not all of them can read, but particularly what we call the house slaves can very often. And of course, there's the spread of religion, the Protestant religion, which inadvertently, of course, so they can read the Bible, teaches enslaved workers how to read, and then they can read the newspapers. So they could read. They would hear the kind of fairly rabid things that were being said in the newspapers, in the parliament, and they would believe. And it became a common belief that the king had authorised and freed them, but the local slaveholders weren't permitting that. So very often they assumed that they would have the support of the British soldiers in the colony because the king had ordered their freedom. And if you're that oppressed, you're desperate, and you believe that the king has ordered your freedom, well, that's a big spur to rebellion. And Demerara was one, 1831 in Jamaica was another. And the increase of these in the 19th century, there was another one in Barbados and so on, I think began to convince the enslavers in the Caribbean that they were going to lose in the end. We had the rebellion, the successful revolution in Haiti, which must have been such a shock. The richest sugar colony in the world passes over to the hands of the enslaved labourers. So they were edgy about all this. And I just want to add in to, I know you mentioned Demerara, so I'm not really answering that question, but 1831, not only did we have the rebellion in Jamaica, but we had an uprising in the United States. We had a general strike in 1832 in the north of England. They would have read in France of the 1831 a revolution there that brought down the previous monarchy. So I think we have also the feeling that must have been amongst the British ruling class that they were fighting on all fronts and that they needed to get rid of one of those fronts. And I think you combine that idea of the rebellion in the Caribbean with the mass movement in Britain, and I don't think you can divorce the two, and the other class struggles that were happening in Britain in that period, that finally convinced them that, as we say, the game wasn't worth the candle.
So we focused on several chapters in this book. What else do you, what are some of the other fundamental arguments you make in this book?
I argue that basically what I'm saying is that modern racism developed as a result, and this is one of the things you might have asked about Eric Williams earlier. Eric Williams' said that racism is a result of slavery. Slavery wasn't a result of racism. And that modern racism developed as a result of slavery. And we are still living with that legacy. It's not that long ago in the United States that it required a massive civil rights movement to even get African Americans the vote. We've recently had here in Britain what we call the Windrush scandal, where people who came from the British West Indies when they were still colonies, but never got British citizenship because they thought they always had it, have been deported and so on. The police, the stop and search, the whole institutional racism of the police and the Home Office all go back, in my view, to slavery. And I think we have to come to terms with that, to say that that was what was behind it, and to try and make the British establishment fess up to it. And so therefore, I've been involved in recent years with a campaign for reparations for enslavement. And that's not just arguing for compensation. I was arguing in one sense for compensation for the wages that the ancestors of the modern people from the African diaspora were not paid, but also to say that part of reparations is changing the education system. It's a whole range of things like that will face up to that legacy. And so I know it's not much to ask for an apology from the British state, but that would be a first step. And I think that that is a really important thing, that we demand it and we explain why. And it's actually a way for me of explaining to workers in Britain the origins of racism and how it has divided workers for many years and how we have all suffered as a result of that.
Steve Cushion, Senior Research Fellow at the Institute of the Americas at University College London. His new book is Slavery and the British Empire and Its Legacy in the Modern World. We have a link to that book on our website, againstthegrain.org. Steve, thank you very much for your work and for joining us today.
Thank you very much for the invitation. I much appreciate it.
In the few minutes we have remaining, we'll revisit remarks made by Caitlin Rosenthal, a scholar Steve cites in his book, in a section about the management techniques used by plantation owners in the British West Indies. Rosenthal, a UC Berkeley-based historian, joined me in 2020 to talk about an article she wrote titled Capitalism Where Labor Was Capital, Slavery, Power, and Price in Antebellum America. Here's Caitlin Rosenthal.
Many definitions of capitalism rely on wage labor. They say that the rise of wage labor is a key component of the emergence of modern capitalism. Now, if this is the definition you use, then slavery wouldn't be capitalist by definition. So by setting aside the definitions while we go to explore, we can start to see deep parallels and connections in the archive. So in my case, I was able to go to business records from slave plantations, of which thousands and thousands survive, and start to see how those looked a whole lot like those worked in free factories, and sometimes they actually looked more advanced than the ones used in free factories.
So in other words, obviously wages were not paid to enslaved people, and yet you see certain parallels between wage labor and this kind of labor, forced labor, coerced labor?
So if we think back through why wage labor was important to definitions of capitalism, it's not that there's something magical about being paid an hourly wage that makes something capitalist. It's the fact that having an hourly wage usually reflects a power structure where capitalists own the means of production and they are able to dominate laborers and they're able to treat them as basically interchangeable, where I don't care if we have a long relationship, I just want an hour of your labor, and if you're not going to give it to me, I'll be happy to have an hour of someone else's labor. The laborer is highly commodified and therefore replaceable. And so that's the kind of connection that I started to follow when I was thinking about new and broader ways to define capitalism. So instead of wage labor, if we say capitalism is characterized by commodification of labor, then all of a sudden you can see these connections between the system of slavery and the system of wage labor, where enslaved people are treated as, to a remarkable extent, considering these are complex, multifaceted human beings, as interchangeable. The unit of analysis is no longer an hour of work, it's someone's entire life. But planters use all kinds of calculations to think about enslaved people as fungible and interchangeable.
You write that the crucial characteristic of capitalism is not commoditization, but the power to commoditize. Elaborate on that.
I think of commodification or commoditization, and I use the two words interchangeably, as a symptom of when capitalism is present. And it reflects the power of an employer, or in this case of enslaved people, an owner or master, to dominate labor. And commodification is like a symptom or reflection of that power.
So we have talked about kind of your understanding of capitalism. How then do you define it in this essay?
Capitalism exists where labor can be highly commodified, and the power to commodify is a reflection of the underlying distribution of capital. Put slightly differently, when capital resources are concentrated into a small number of hands, even if you have a market, the owners of capital will have massively disproportionate power in that market. And that lets them commodify labor to treat it as interchangeable, which in turn kind of intensifies the same process by which capital is accumulated.
Caitlin Rosenthal teaches history at UC Berkeley. She's the author of Accounting for Slavery, Masters and Management. And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more.